And while they're heading out, if the adults just want to talk for a moment amongst yourselves, maybe you've been thinking, just in reflecting on what I was talking about, is there something that you do, your body does, to try and make sense of faith in the midst of chaos?
Okay. So about a year ago, Helen asked me if I would talk about some paintings that I'd like, ones that are important to me. And I sat down, and my task that I set myself was to say, what paintings can I bring to mind? Because clearly they will have had an impact on me. And there were several hundred, and I'm not going to share them all. But these are the ones which I think have shaped me and enlarged me. I'm not an expert. I'm an amateur fan of art. I've been fortunate enough to travel the world and see many of these paintings in real life. And I did, a decade ago, a paper in art history at Canterbury. And I came top of the class. Justin, my brother-in-law, said that that's not difficult because I was the only student not distracted like first years by whether they'd get lucky on the weekend. Which just goes to show how little my brother-in-law knows about me and how he persists in thinking that luck has anything to do with it. Paintings have always been a really important part of the Christian story. They're the ways that for millennia the story was told. You know, it's passed down orally and in paintings, often to illiterate people. And paintings are also a way that artists try and make sense of things. They're trying to communicate human feelings and experience and knowledge and ideas, sometimes things that actually can't be expressed in words. Just like Rochelle was saying, sometimes experiences have to be embodied. And all paintings in some ways, even the really realistic ones, are abstract, and they invite us to enter into the scene. And at the outset, can I challenge you to think about two things? First of all, like music, we don't like art. It's usually that we're more or less familiar with a type of art or an artist. And the second is that we don't judge art. As we expose ourselves to it, it judges us. So starting in childhood, this is the first ever painting that I saw. It's a piece of Keach print, and it hung in the kitchen dining room of our very cold, very old weatherboard home outside of Invercargill. And the sea was grey and cold, and the sky is relentless and threatening with rain, and it's miserable. And it was pretty much like the beach at Ōreete, where I only swam once. And that day we were chased out of the water by sharks. So the first piece of art that I ever saw impressed upon me that the sea was cold and fierce. There's no doubt in my mind that that formed my fear and lack of interest in the sea and the surf. And it was in that surf that Anna and I almost drowned just after we got engaged in the sea at Piha. And as Bono sang in the song that we've just listened to, every sailor knows that the sea is a friend made enemy. And as Liz Robinson often says, things that we have seen cannot be unseen. And we often think about that principle when we talk about pornography, but perhaps it applies to all the things that we see, that they all form us. Now, I'm aware that not everybody looks at this painting thinks it as darkly as I do. I mean, I've got a surf life-saving friend and she loves it, which really reflects the fact that we bring ourselves to art as well as art comes to us. Nevertheless, this was what I grew up with. My schoolmates, however, were looking at Tina. And many of you will remember her. There's millions of these prints produced worldwide and you can still find them in op shops around the world. And in my childhood, Tina hung alongside yard glasses, and it was on the wall of non-Christians and Catholics. And Tina was the ideal woman. She's a woman in a patriarchal world. She's an object of desire. And as a young brother and boy, a dangerous temptress who could cause me to fall and control me based on how she was dressed or undressed. And in this view, women are evil and men are unable to control themselves, and boys will be boys and men will be boys. And if I could say one thing to parents here, don't bring your children up to think that that is true. This painting is called The Swallow, and it's painted by the Wellingtonian Raymond Chinnan. And Chin was he was inspired on a school trip to the Wellington Museum when he was a boy. He saw stuffed hummingbirds, and that set him on a life of painting birds. And you should never underestimate the power of museum visits on young minds. The painting hangs in my cousin's house in Dunedin. It was bought by my very wealthy uncle, and he also bought the book on which the painting features on the cover. I first saw this painting when I was about 14, and to me it invokes the sense of liminality. Because growing up in Southland, I was struck by the fact that there were a lot of old abandoned houses, houses with broken windows boarded up like this window, perhaps now a barn, perhaps just a broken down implement shed, or maybe there's just a chimney, a symbol of decay that inevitably occurs despite our best efforts. Nothing's lasting, not even our greatest endeavours. Southland was also an incredibly beautiful and wild place, and in my summer high school holidays I had a job that was monitoring river flows for the Southland Catchment Board, and this is McKellar Flat on the northern Arete River. It's painted by the artist Peter Beadle, and the painting was gifted to my father when he retired from the Southland Catchment Board, which is now Environment Southland, and it hangs in our hallway at home, and if you come for soup and buns, it's one of many of the paintings that we've got on display. Beadle was a master of painting light, and what appeals to me is at how he could, like all great artists, with a single brush stroke, represent something, maybe just a puff of cloud, snow on a ridge, or in the foreground, just with a single brush stroke, an entire Hereford cow. It's remarkable how easily our mind can fill in gaps and see things that aren't actually there. Our visual system does that all the time. Now, in the 1960s and 1970s, good brethren Southlanders liked to holiday in Queenstown, and this is a screen print from The Gondola. The exact print, if I recall, is somewhere in my sister's lockup, and the artist Malcolm Wall was famous because he developed a technique that allowed him to print two colours on each pass of his screen print. And I actually don't like this painting. They're too beige. And can I say that, you know, in a world of colour, please don't dress in beige. You know, don't go to Country Road. But what fascinated me, I was drawn to this painting. It was like a magnet. And the thing that fascinated me was the way that Wall creates a sense of depth. Now, I first saw this painting in the 1970s. At that time, I was probably 16 or 17. I was planning to be a farmer. And Nick Cave writes in his book how songs can have a way of predicting the future, that songs he wrote actually seemed much, much more relevant later in life. And my actual future lay in vision. And in my second year at university, I learned how we judge distance. So we're all aware of, you know, stereopsis, 3D vision, but we actually judge depth by using a whole lot of cues, which are both non-visual and visual, and some of them only need one eye, and they're called the monocular cues. And Waugh is a master of using these to create depths. In particular, he uses aerial perspective and interposition, one thing in front of another, and atmospheric perspective. And so whether he knew that or whether he innately understood it or learned it, what he was actually doing was representing a way of seeing, and he was teaching me how I see. And so off I went to university, and this is the first painting I ever remember at university. It hung in the main Auckland University Library, painted by Gordon Walters, and he made hundreds of versions of this. I don't know if this is the exact one. But it was a total shock to me. It was a shock because it was unmistakably Māori in its koru and the colour palette, and it was unbelievably or unmistakably abstract in a European art tradition. It blended two worlds, and it was unmistakably New Zealand. And I found it incredibly attractive. I loved the simplicity of it. I loved the fact that you could wander your eye through it like a labyrinth. And it seemed to me that there were really thin spaces, as we often talk about here, thin spaces between us and others, or us and the numinous. And I just loved this precision and the vibrancy from just three colours. It also started to crack open really what was a very white male Pākehā and racist Southland mind. This is a slightly difficult painting to project because it's so detailed and with the lights on, but it's a very important part of my journey. It's called the Hallucinogenic Toreador, and it was the first piece of art that I ever bought on a Saturday morning on Mount Eden Road in a pop-up. And I was absolutely fascinated by it, and most people who saw it were absolutely appalled. The theme is bullfighting. Dali's wife in the near top left loathed bullfighting, and he painted this as a response. And there's a bull that lies dying in a pool of saliva and blood, but in the corner of the pool, there's a little guy floating on a raft. There's all of these idealized Venus de Milos that Dali is contrasting his wife with, who she is and what he hoped she'd be. And so there's lots of these torsos. You'll see that all these visual illusions. So the nose of the Toreador becomes the breast of one of the Venus de Milos, or vice versa. Pete Magini was talking a couple of weeks ago about how when he was learning to paint, he was only allowed to paint heads and not torsos. And Peter, if you just thought, you could have just said to your art teacher you were just painting noses, and they just happened to be lined up in the right arrangement. There's a tip for you going forward, Peter. So young Dali watches from the bottom right-hand corner, and emerging from the pool, there's a dog, a spotted dog that looks surprisingly like hashtag Ilam's favourite dog. The theme is bullfighting, and Dali's wife's aversion to it, but there's just this amazing mixture of symbolism and motif and optical illusion. And we like to think of our faith as having a very logical basis, but even our Bible is mostly poems, parables, and letters to other folk. And I just don't understand how you can read the book of Revelation and not like artworks like this. This was my first ever encounter with Colin McCann. The black and yellow acrylic artwork on the left denotes that you're on the ground floor of the medical school in Auckland. There are others that I haven't got photos of, so there's lower ground and there's the five floors in Roman numerals. And each acrylic square in 1984 was fixed to the metal window frame by four Phillips screws. And our friend Matt suggested that he and I should steal them because the university needed a lesson in how valuable the art was. And I'm glad that I chickened out, because I wouldn't like to be standing here today having ruined some of McCann's art. But what McCann does here is he takes something that's supremely everyday ordinary and makes it art. On the right is one of his numbers, the number two. There are four twos in my cell phone number, just numbers, but McCann makes them beautiful. And the ordinary becomes transcendent. There's a Benedictine saying that is, worship is a long, loving look at the real or the ordinary. This painting, called Victory Over Death 2, was gifted by the New Zealand government to the Australian government on the event of its bicentenary in 1978. It's a huge painting, 2 metres high, about 5 metres long, and it hangs in the National Gallery in Canberra. And it's hard to see in a place like this, but on the left is a negative question, am I, in contrast with the more assertive, I am, on the right. And for me, this painting illustrates the brilliance of McCann because it operates at many levels. McCann was a struggling artist seeking to assert his identity. New Zealand was asserting its identity on the national stage. McCann was a nationalist. And we can see this painting as something where New Zealand is saying, I am, but with a bit of a am I in the background. I Am is also the name that God gave themselves when Moses asked, who am I going to tell has sent me? And God replies, tell them, I Am has sent me. Jesus asked the disciples, who do you say that I am? To which Peter replied, you're the Messiah. And Jesus makes this odd assertion about himself. He says, I am. He's using the words, I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life. And it's also a crucifixion painting, because we see in the text there's clearly the voice of Jesus in agony saying, Father, glorify thy name. And in 1992, I stood in front of this painting, and it asked me, who are you? Who am I? I'd learned the day before that I had failed my first attempt to pass the ophthalmology entry exam. I was on the other side of the Tasman. I was a long way away from Anna. I was a long way away from home. I was uncertain of my future. I didn't know whether I would become an ophthalmologist. And the painting still invites me to consider my identity. Because more than ever, we live in a world where we're questioning our identity. Who are we? Are we binary? Are we non-binary? What is our identity? And I think one of the church's unique selling points is that our identity is in Christ. We are loved into existence. We are redeemed into further existence. And I think that this idea that I am is a foundational part of our identity is a really important part of that discussion. Most of you will remember or have seen Rembrandt's Prodigal Son. Anna and I have been fortunate enough to see it in St. Petersburg. There's lots of different interpretations, but the two key messages for me are that, first, this is mercy personified. Mercy in a weary, weary world. The Father is there in just an endless embrace, a tender silence, a moment stretching into eternity, and we're invited into that. And the second is that we like to think, well, we're often told, at least I was, that we are prodigal sons and daughters, and some of us are and were, and delight in being. But usually we're actually, in fact, the older brother, the Pharisee, the judgmental. It's much harder for the judgmental to come home and to find mercy. But then ultimately the invitation is for us to become the father and to be agents of that mercy and grace. Now, I said that I don't like the sea, and that's still true, but I do love rivers. And rivers are a really important part of Celtic spirituality in particular. They speak of life and of cleansing. Jesus was baptized in a river. Rivers flow on and on. And the same river was flowing in my forefathers' time and in my time, and, of course, I hope in my children's and grandchildren's time. This artist, Petrus van der Velden, saw the moody drama of the Otera Gorge on dark, rainy days as expressive of the presence of God. And when the thunder was rolling and the skies were opening, as it can only do in Otera, van der Velden would go into the gorge and paint, whereas if the sun was shining, he'd lie on his back outside the Otera Hotel and go to sleep. And once I saw this painting, I really started to see the Otera Gorge in all of its magnificence. It helped me to fall in love with this treasure that flows in the middle of our two coasts. Now, some see this painting as very kitsch. Not as kitsch as this, which is Milton Springsteen's reworking of the painting. Now, everybody knows about the mysterious Banksy. Christchurch has Springsteen. It's rumoured that only the curator of the Christchurch Art Gallery knows who or he or she is. But here in the bottom left, Gollum is fishing, and the Lord of the Rings crew have left their camera on a rock down the bottom right, and they've gone off to a coffee cart and having a morning tea break. Now, as New Zealanders, we've got several origin stories. We've got our sort of Greco-Roman origin, we've got our Judeo-Christian origin, we've got our European migration, we've got our Maori myths and legends. And then along comes the Lord of the Rings and places another layer onto our New Zealanders. our New Zealand identity, the story of Middle Earth. And we've gone from myths of creation to the creation of a myth, which has really been imposed upon us. But the next time you drive beside the Otira River, I'm pretty sure you'll find yourself wondering if Gollum is out there fishing today. This is the Haast River. It's painted by my friend Brent Trelay, a West Coast artist. Now, as a young man, Brent wanted to be a painter, and so he boldly knocked on the door of Austin Deans. Austin is one of the great Canterbury artists. And when Brent explained what he wanted to do, artist Austin turned on his heel and walked down the corridor and disappeared. He came back with a single tube of paint, and he said, simply, use this and this alone, and if you still want to be a painter in a year, come back and see me. So Brent did that, and he came back, and he knocked on the door, and this time Austin turned on his heel, went down, and got two tubes of paint, and came back a third time a year later, and Austin invited Brent in and became his mentor. Brent really wanted to be a painter, and Austin tested him in the same way as Jesus tested his disciples when he asked Peter three times, do you love me? It takes a while sometimes to really get the answer. And Aquinas said that to be effeminate is to forsake a good on account of long endurance of difficulties and toils. And in New Zealand, we think of manliness as opposed to effeminate as something completely different, largely based on physical prowess. But I think we need to think the definition of manliness and womanliness, because it involves a long and dedicated and toil-filled life. Anna and I have always been drawn to Caravaggio. We love how he places ordinary people into biblical stories. And we've got a framed print of this painting. We bought it after we'd toured around Rome for several days, trying to see every Caravaggio that we could. And for many years, it hung at the top of our stairs. The incredulity of St. Thomas shows Christ actually guiding Thomas's finger into the wound in his side. And the unbelieving Thomas is depicted as a peasant. He's dressed in a torn robe, and there's dirt underneath his fingernails. And the composition is such that the heads and the arms form crosses. And we are invited into this painting because I am a doubting Thomas. This is one of McCann's paintings, perhaps the most important to me. It was one of six pictures in a calendar my brother-in-law Andrew gave me for Christmas the year we moved to Christchurch from Auckland. And I hated Christchurch. It's so flat. It's so dull. It's so interesting that the locals get excited by Norwest arches in the sky. This painting is called 6 Days in Nelson in Canterbury. And there's very elemental forms with a very strong dividing horizon. There's Rangi above and Papatūānuku below. And what it did for me is it helped me to deconstruct and then reconstruct the landforms of Canterbury. I was discovering what McCann had seen earlier, and I'm going to quote from him. He said, big hills stood in front of little hills that rose up distantly from the flat land. There was a landscape of splendor, order, and peace. And I saw something logical, orderly, and belonging to the land and also to its people. And this is, I think, the key thing for me. Not yet understood, and that's where I started my life in Canterbury, and not yet communicated, but not even yet invented. And my task as an artist has been largely to communicate a vision and invent a way to see it. 6 Days was painted after McCann spent a summer in Nelson, Canterbury, and during one bike ride he fell off and cut his knee, and that might be the reason for the red stripe down the centre, but I think it goes a lot deeper than that. There are 6 days in the Genesis creation myth, and McCann was very familiar with classical paintings in which blood is daubed on the doorposts of the houses of Israelites in Egypt, or flows in a sort of arc like a waterfall coming out of the side of the wounded Christ. In painting, red is the colour of sacrifice and through that salvation. And in many of McCann's paintings, there's this theme of Jesus being poured out not just for people, but also for the land, and in particular the land of this nation. McCann took the cross out of painting, you know, as a symbol, and he used this red stripe or curve as a device to give us a sense that the Godhead was present in the land and that God is concerned for all of creation. And then ultimately the land cries out in worship. Lilias Trotter, the artist here, was an extraordinary woman. The art critic Ruskin is said to have seen more paintings in a life than any other person in history. And having seen Lilias's work, he said that if she would devote herself to her art, she would be the greatest living painter and do things that would be immortal. And she gave it all away. She went off to Algeria to be a self-supporting missionary. She learned Arabic in order to share the gospel with Muslim women. Now, we're very familiar in the church with this imagery that the church is the bride of Christ, but what Trotter's trying to say here is that the land itself, in all of its majestic beauty, is also a bride adorned for its creator. Now, like Marcos, I know a bit about light, and this is a definition of light, and it's the one that I learned for exams. But what I really like much more than definitions is actually looking at it. This is also quite a dark painting. It's called Whistler's Nocturne or Falling Rocket, and the subject is fireworks, and I love fireworks. When I'm going to watch fireworks, I try and get directly underneath so that the fireworks fills my entire visual field. To me, they're just the ultimate eye candy, just an explosion that excites my whole visual system. And I also love the night and the star fields, the fact that there's nothing in the mid part, there's just near and distant. And many years ago when we were sitting around a fire over on the west coast with our friends, I wrote a poem, and one of the lines was, "We only see near and distant. There's nothing in between, for that space is the habitat of spirits yet unseen." And one of the benefits of having Quinn, hashtag Ilam's favourite dog, is that in my life, on most days, I get to see the star fields in the morning and night on my walks. Light can also be used to reimagine a place. Greymouth is aptly named grey. Even on a good day, it's grey, and the wind, called the barber, does cut like a barber's knife. But this is Toss Wollaston's painting of Greymouth, and it's called Sunset Grey River, and it kind of reframes our view by painting the very best of what's there. Now, Wollaston was perfectly aware of the drabness at Greymouth. He described the landscape of the coast as a great violence in subdued colours. But in this painting, from this unusual elevated view looking down over Greymouth, which was then just a bustling coal port, the setting sun for a moment illuminates the town with this magnificent golden light. And in fact, the coasters often talk about the very final setting as being a flash of green, and you can see that. The setting sun floods the town, and there's just this storm of brush strokes because you have to capture it really quickly, this golden glory. There's another kind of light, and in the paintings of the Eastern Orthodox Church, there's this light known as uncreated or Tabor light. And in the Genesis story, there was light before the sun and the moon were created. The same light that shone from Jesus at Mount Tabor. This is a spiritual light. And in iconography, it's dusting. And you can see it just on the clothes, the beard, the hair, the folds of the clothes, is dusting of light, which is emanating from rather than being reflected back. And according to Eastern tradition, if a painting is like this, it tells you that they're a saint because they have received or found this divine radiance like came from Jesus on Mount Tabor. McCann also painted light. This painting records his first meeting with the poet James K. Baxter. And McCann thought that Baxter was a candle. And he's trying to express here the idea that artists can map out the relationship between man and God. And, of course, you remember that in the parable of the bushel, Jesus encourages us to be light and not hiding ourselves under a bushel. McCann placed the Christian story in New Zealand. He never claimed to be a Christian or a Catholic, but he did a lot of work in those spheres, and his painting here makes the gospel story accessible to New Zealanders, because a lot of religious art codifies things. You have to be really familiar with what the symbols mean. So, you know, for example, the halo on a saint, or the use of a dove to represent the Holy Spirit. But in this painting, which is called I Paul to You at Ngāti Moti, the symbols are very New Zealand. I mean, there's a Maori man, there's barbed wire, there's pastures, and the top dressing plane represents the Holy Spirit. So the prophet Paul has alighted in New Zealand and he's telling the story. He's in rural New Zealand. And so this biblical message kind of reverberates around the hills of New Zealand. McCann also placed the crucifixion in New Zealand. This is his crucifixion to St. Mark. It's a very bright, childlike painting. There's light of extraordinary intensity. There's almost like plasticine blocks in the background. It's one of those endless long summer days of Aotearoa. And there's darkness. And this is a crude painting, even for McCann. Crucifixion is crude. Crucifixion is raw. It's just this scar that cuts through religion and time. In the background, Jerusalem's temple, which we read was torn in two when Christ was crucified, is exploded out of a simple New Zealand country church by an atomic explosion. And there's these speech balloons which are cartoonish, which express the words of Christ and those around the cross. And there's this sort of kind of intimacy that comes from that. Baxter called it a very Presbyterian painting rather than a Catholic one. There's a very Protestant sort of faith. And McCann paints himself into the story. He's the little face on the side. He's the observer. Because we're all, in a sense, a participation or precipitatory partner in the crucifixion. Crucifixion is a trope. The crucifixion of Jesus was at its heart a lynching. Jesus was killed because he stood up to those who were in power, and sadly, of course, those who were of a religious inclination, which is really an unpleasant place for us to be. But we are also recipients of the power of the resurrection. This is McCann's Easter morning. It's dawn, a new dawn, and light comes from both the rising sun in the east and also the risen sun in the empty tomb. And in placing the resurrection tomb at the collision visually of land and sea, McCann declares that the resurrection is not just for the disciples, but for the whole world, even to the ends of the earth in Aotearoa, and even for the land. The church, however, has often failed to tell that story. Ben Gogh's Starry, Starry Night is probably one of the most instantly recognisable images in the world. It's a painting of a former Christian missionary now turned painter. And there's these beautiful spiral nebulae now known as galaxies that fill the star fields. And Vincent told his brother that when I feel this tremendous need for what I am going to call religion, I go outside at night and paint the stars. But in this painting, the church is central. You can see it as a small image right down the bottom. And it passes from a worldly to a heaven-touching structure, but its lights are out. The village lights are on, and no light emanates from the church. That's how Vincent experienced the church, a very painful experience for him. So the question is, does light come from our church, from Ilam? This and the next painting are two paintings by New Zealand artist Michael Stevenson. I discovered him. These are the only two paintings that I didn't bring to mind when I was sitting to plan this. And they took my breath away, because Stevenson was raised in a Pentecostal church and he also attended Brethren churches. And this painting is titled Jesus Loves Us All in Clinton. And Clinton, you know, is that small town in South Otago. And some of the churches are Presbyterian, some of them are Brethren, and the interior of this church is very much like I would have grown up in. I think that's a flannel board to tell the Sunday school stories on the left-hand side. But the interesting thing is, there's nothing out the window. So is there no one out the window, or is Jesus loves us all only directed to the congregation? Or is it a message that you're supposed to take out to the world outside of that window? It's easy for us to feel that we're loved because we know the lingo and we have the relationships and we can tell the stories and so on. But it's very much harder to take that exclusivity out into a broader society. This is another painting by Stevenson, and you'll note that there's a handily placed exit door. Is that inviting us to escape from the church, like many Islamites have over the years? Or is it inviting us to go out into the world with a relevant message? These are paintings of just small, very undemonstrable churches. They're nothing churches in suburban and provincial New Zealand. But they do speak of a God who is omnipresent, even in those places. This is not I, Paul, to Ngāti Moti, the apostle coming in and proclaiming things throughout the whole land. This is just everyday statements chosen by people who have been touched by God to say this is something that we think is real, even in Clinton. Matisse's The Dance was my first visual exploration of what communing with the divine might look like. We saw this in St. Petersburg in Russia many years ago. And after all, there are three persons in the Trinity, so surely if we come into a relationship with the Trinity, there'd be more. There'd be at least four. And in this painting, of course, there's five. And that's what I like about this. I like this sort of vibrant, rhythmical succession of sort of dancing nudes to convey this feeling of emotional liberation and hedonism. There's a type of Torah reading in Judaism called Simchat Torah. And on occasions when the ark is opened, the worshippers leave their seats and they dance and sing with the Torah scrolls in what is an incredibly joyous celebration. And that can last for hours. And we're invited into that kind of celebration of what we do as well. You can think of some of the old hymns. One of the ones that came to mind as I was writing this was that one where it has the line, "Change from glory into glory, till in heaven we take our place, till we cast our crowns before you, lost in wonder, love and praise." We're just invited into this huge dance. And we're invited into this Trinity. So this is Rubloff's Trinity. Pastor Peter, who was here before Sean, loved this painting, and you've seen it several times. It depicts three angels who visited Abraham in the Genesis story. It's full of symbolism, and it's interpreted as an icon of the Holy Trinity. And the angels are arranged in a sort of circular way so that their bodies and heads and arms all create a central circle, and there's almost a space for us as individuals at the bottom. But our eyes are drawn into the center. It's a painting that invites us into it. There's space for us. And about a year ago, when I was thinking about, if you like, prayer or entering into the numinous or whatever it is, I found this painting suddenly became animated. And so now when I turn my mind to prayer, I see this image. And these people are not static, but they're laughing and they're happy and they're totally in love with each other, but they're also incredibly welcoming. And so they kind of say, yeah, come on back in. Yeah, it's cool. That's what icons are supposed to do. They're supposed to act as windows that we can walk through into. And sadly this week, that icon was returned to the custody of the Russian Orthodox Church and put on display at the Cathedral of Christ the Saviour by Vladimir Putin's direct order. It's part of his obsession with the Holy Rus. It's the ultimate sort of brown tongue relationship that exists at the moment between the Orthodox Church in Moscow and Vladimir Putin. Putin supporting Patriarch Kirill and Kirill supporting Putin. And it's an excellent example of how art can be weaponized and politicized. Now, Anna and I have our own icon, and you can see that at our place over soup and buns. It's a painting of James Baldwin by the iconologist Kelly Lattimore. Baldwin was an American writer. He exposed and explores personal questions and dilemmas about masculinity, sexuality, race and class. And we find this painting, this icon, useful. It reminds us, obviously, of God's love, but also that the issues that Baldwin wrestled with are also the tasks for us to wrestle with as well. And I was going to stop there, but I have to come back from Trinity and icons to this painting, The Song of the Surf. I said that I hated it, its coldness, but that's not the whole story. Because a month ago, on one of my op shop runs, I found it for sale in the Salvation Army store at Church Corner. The painting that I had not seen for probably four decades. Now, the Sallys had done their homework, and they know that it's quite a collector's item. They had sale for $2,000, and there is one for sale on eBay for £850, but they, you know, brought the price down, and I wondered about buying it, but I decided that, you know, who pays $150 for an old print? And I took a photo and I chatted to the lady at the desk about that. But the next day was Mother's Day, and I thought about her and this painting, because see, this was my mother's painting. She loved it. It was very, very precious to her. And I looked at the photo that I had taken, this photo, and I started to see it in a different light. I started to see that waves are really spectacular and an extraordinary and ever-changing marvel. Why the painting is a little bit like wars. It has aerial perspective and atmospheric perspective. And the crests of the waves, well, is that just a touch of table light? There's just a little golden shimmer that I'd never seen or remembered when I was a boy. So that was Mother's Day, Sunday. On Monday, I went back and bought it. And my lovely assistant will reveal it. I didn't pay $150. I'm a very expert op shopper, and I just made them an offer, which was accepted. Everything's negotiable at family stores. You see, this painting started to bring back other memories of my childhood. It hung in our family room. It hung above the Mackay wood burner. Above that, we pulled all of our washing on a rack. It was a warm room. And in that room, my mother cooked our meals. My father baked the Sunday pavlova, and we entertained visiting preachers on Sunday evenings. My mother invited them so that as a child we could hear what people said and we could ask questions. It was the family room, the room in which in the winter, particularly when we were sick, we all retreated as a family. It was the only warm room. And so I have all these beautiful, rich memories of the four of us, Mum and Dad and my sister and I, sleeping in there. So in fact, apart from the painting, all of my memories of this room are warm and safe and good. And in seeing this painting, my visual memories and my memories are all redeemed. And then I started realizing that when Bono sang Every Breaking Wave, he doesn't stop at "the sea is a friend made enemy." But he continues, "Are you ready to be swept off your feet and stop chasing every breaking wave?" Bono writes that the song is a depiction of lovers who are down the road and running out of rhythm and momentum. Friendships can run out of gas. Romantic love always will. And Bono says that he's asking whether we can abandon ourselves to one and only one lover and stop chasing other breaking waves. And as you know, and Bono knows, all good love songs about men and women are just proxies for our relationship with the I Am, which got me thinking about my faith, my friends, my marriage. Some of us are at the beginning of life, at the beginning of friendships, the beginning of relationships, and there's other songs you should be listening to from the U2 collection, something like Song for Someone. But for those of us further down the road, how do we abandon ourselves to our friends, our lovers, our God? I mean, I've been trying to find a relationship with the I Am for 45 plus years. I have friends in this congregation who've been friends for 40 years. I've been married for 33 years. How do I stop paddling in the shallow water and go back into those waves and allow myself to be swept off my feet? And there you are. So it started with an idea from Helen. Then me thinking that I could give you some ideas about art that I've enjoyed. And then these paintings have ended up challenging me. Because when you expose yourself to art, art exposes you. So we're now going to sing that song. We're going to try congregationally singing a U2 song.